This is Law and Disorder.
As part of our Lawyers You'll Like series, today we're talking with David Carries from Philadelphia. He has been a leader in efforts to fight discrimination and to protect individual rights. He's now regarded as one of the nation's preeminent civil rights attorneys. We'll speak with a retired auto worker from Detroit who describes the shocking conditions there.
Is the Obama administration helping the workers or is it helping the car companies? Can it possibly do both?
Stay with us. Part of our Lawyers You'll Like series, today we're talking with David Carries from Philadelphia. David began his career at the Philadelphia Public Defender's Office in the late 1960s. Since then, he has been a leader in efforts to fight discrimination and to protect individual rights. He's now regarded as one of the nation's preeminent civil rights attorneys. David is a professor at Temple University Law School, where he teaches civil rights and constitutional law. He has written several books, including the most recent Philadelphia Freedom, Memoir of a Civil Rights Lawyer, which we'll discuss today.
Hello, David, and welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi, Michael.
We're here to interview and talk to David about his latest book, Philadelphia Freedom, Memoir of a Civil Rights Lawyer. And I just want to say a personal thing. I've known David forever, actually. We went to Cuba in 1973 together. David still has the hidden videotapes of our trip. But when I picked up the book, I thought, oh, another book about law. But of course, David's one of the most prominent civil liberties lawyer in the country and certainly around the Northeast in Philadelphia, well known. And when I picked up the book, I actually couldn't put it down. So I really want to recommend it because it's a book of stories, really, of some remarkable cases and David's role in them that really documents really the history of this country over the last 40 years. So I highly recommend it. So thank you for doing it, David.
Thank you, Mike.
It's a book of stories, but I think equally important, it's a book about themes and what we call people's lawyering. The first chapter in the book talks about Mr. Giles and his case, which we thought exemplified the dual importance of sort of taking a case to the streets as well as to the courts. Although in this case, it was mostly about a campaign that you waged on behalf of a man who'd escaped from prison and been living a good life, a productive life in Philadelphia. We were interested to know how you knew how to organize with the editorials and the educational campaign. Did that just come instinctively?
Well, I really didn't know, and I tried to show that as honestly as I could in the book, because I really just went from idea to idea, and at some point it did occur to me that what I was organizing was more a political campaign than anything else. The guy had escaped from the Georgia Chain Gang 25 years earlier, about when I was born. I was in my first 2 weeks in the public defender office, and I really didn't know much of anything.
That's what I couldn't get over, David. We'd gone to law school. You were maybe a year ahead of me or so, but you didn't know anything. You just got out of law school a year or so before.
Yeah, and I didn't even know enough to know how little I knew. You know?
That's the best thing, maybe, David. But go ahead and continue on the story. You were working at the public defenders in Philadelphia.
And this woman who, with this gravelly but resonant sort of voice that immediately struck me as being interviewed by my office mate. I am not in the bar yet. You know, I'm barely able to do anything. And so I started listening. And she's very upset. She's gesturing her arms and crying. And the story comes out that her husband was taken in the night before for nothing that amounted to anything, but he got fingerprinted. Fingerprint showed he was this fellow who escaped from a Georgia chain gang, convicted of murder. The authorities in Georgia wanted him back. And the experienced lawyer my office mate explained that there really wasn't anything the office could do or any lawyer could do, because for an extradition, all the state of Georgia had to show was that a crime was committed and that he was the person either charged or, in this case, actually convicted of committing it. And any other complaints about the trial or, for instance, was an all-white jury, he really had no lawyer, it was a terrible kind of injustice, but all of that would be raised in Georgia when you go back. So I just had this urge to intervene, and to a large extent, I think the book is about my dealing with that urge or not in various situations. So I didn't know what I was going to do, but I asked, could I go interview him and look into it? And he was a little perturbed, which I certainly didn't blame him for, because he was experienced and I knew absolutely nothing. Anyway, as it turns out, I start researching it, and I did find that there was this one opening, which was, as a routine process, all extraditions require that the governor of the state in which the person's picked up sign what's called the extradition warrant. And without the governor's signature on that warrant, the whole thing stops. So I could ask the governor, although no governor in Pennsylvania history had ever done this or even been open to this as far as I knew, I could ask him not to sign and ask for a hearing. And then basically it became a question, how do I influence this recently elected conservative Republican governor? And my colleagues in the public defender office are saying, you know, this is certainly a noble cause, but you're spending an awful lot of time doing something that looks unwinnable. And I had no good answer. I just kept doing it. And eventually I got the major stroke of luck, which was that the Republican district attorney of Philadelphia, Arlen Specter, of course, who's now a well-known senator, had been elected with the support of only one union, and that was the construction union that this man, James Giles, the escapee from the chain gang, had worked for 25 years.
Isn't that incredible? I mean, it is just a piece of luck, David, but on the other hand, you know, what I think, to me, what that story illustrates is, in some way, you make your own luck. You push and push and push, and at some point, whether it was that particular thing that opened up, but something opened up, and I think that's what's really significant here.
It is, and the reality is you don't know. You could make a good case, and it was made to me many times, that I could spend the equivalent time on other injustices. It's not like this was the only thing going on, right?
Right.
But this one fell into my lap. I was just really moved by it, particularly when I went up and talked to him. It turned out it was a fight between two men. It was basically self-defense. He had killed another black man. He was also black. In Georgia, if he'd have killed a white man, he'd have been executed. Since it was another black man and it was a fight, he got life on the chain gang. But so eventually I went to the union, got the union to go to Arlen Specter. I went to Specter, got the probation department to write up a report so Specter would feel he's insulated from criticism, the probation department being responsible for saying, you know, this man is no danger to anyone. And Specter then wrote a letter to the governor, and the governor's office gave me a hearing, and we had petitions, and Mrs. Giles, who was a gospel singer, sang in most every black church in the city, and we won.
Oh, it's remarkable. It reads like a good detective story. I thought I was going to pick up this book and skim through it, and then boom.
David, we also wanted to talk about the well-known Camden 28 draft board case.
Okay.
The FBI set up a sting of Catholic anti-war activists.
You like the ones that seemed hopeless.
Right. Always.
They were caught in the act of basically breaking into the Camden, New Jersey draft board and tearing up and destroying all of the files in every file cabinet in the office.
These were draft files, is that right?
Yes. They started with the 1A, the ones that would be drafted first.
What year was this, David?
The action, 1971.
They started with 1As, right?
Yeah, and then they got to every classification. Now, it turns out that the FBI had an informant in the group who the FBI was paying on an hourly rate to inform on them, and he basically supplied the strategies and the materials necessary to actually make the action happen. But since the FBI knew all about it, it was their option when or whether to bust these people, and they just sat around. There was over 100 FBI agents, and waited until they had destroyed every piece of paper in the office. Then they charge in and arrest everyone.
What was it like dealing with a case that involved the FBI in terms of your strategy and approach?
See, I was still a young lawyer. I just started our firm. We were one of a number of firms really dedicated to civil rights and representation of progressive groups, and we were kind of networked among National Lawyers Guild members with the history of that organization going way back, allied with a lot of civil rights groups, the Emergency Civil Liberties Committee, the Center for Constitutional Rights. Right near the beginning, I got approached to do this case, and my first reaction, which is also in the book, was that it was because I came cheap, was the primary factor. But I did say to them right away, this was a Catholic left action. And so many of them were priests, and a lot of them did this as a moral matter and were quite prepared to go to jail. A number of Father Michael Doyle has become a very good friend, an amazing priest in Camden, which is just one of the poorest inner-city communities in the country. He's still there, standing up for poor people. And he basically said in one of the early meetings, when your government is napalming children, the place you should be is in jail. And so he was prepared to go. They were all kind of prepared to go. And I said, okay, I'll do this case. We'll try to argue that what they did was justified because of the war. That had really never succeeded in any of the anti-war cases. But
the necessity defense?
Yeah, and jury nullification.
Right.
But I said, I'm going to be looking for ways to win this as well, and got their assent. That was what really the basis on which I came in. And I was always interested in this guy that we knew was the informant, Bob Hardy. And what happened was, through Father Doyle, we strategized the way to start talking to Hardy, the informant, and eventually meeting with him. And, of course, we're worried that in those days, you know, people who had cooperated with the anti-FBI side of things had strange ways of bad things happening to them. And so we were worried about that. We had to keep it incredibly secret, and met with him several times, and finally got him to do an affidavit saying that the FBI had basically manufactured this crime, that it never would have happened but for the FBI inserting Hardy in to overcome all of the obstacles. And there were over 300 draft board raids during the Vietnam War. It was a much more prevalent thing than is widely understood. But this one was different in the sense that it required a burglary of the fifth floor of an urban office building. Most all of the others were suburban or even rural draft boards, and people would wait in the men's room, you know, after closing hours, and then come out and raid the board, things like that. Anyway, he did this affidavit that said they made it happen, and the orders came from the Western White House, which was Nixon's California headquarters in San Clemente. I filed the affidavit, and it was front page in the New York Times.
Let me ask you something about... Yes. About this case, because I'm trying to recall if it's the same case that I remember when I was a young lawyer as well. Was everybody arrested actually in the draft board?
No. Some were arrested around the country. They had played some role but weren't there at that time. It was rather than the sort of sophisticated, dangerous conspiracy that J. Edgar Hoover, head of the FBI, and John Mitchell, the attorney general, announced at the arrest. It was really a rather loose group. People came and went, and, you know, they'd come in and help and be told, do this, do that, and then they'd go home. So people were arrested in New York City.
I asked that because of New York City, because at the time, I just graduated law school maybe that year, and I was, or the year after.
I only graduated a year before
I know.
That.
So, my wife was working, Margie Ratner was working up at Legal Services on 116th Street, and the FBI came into her office, and her legal assistant was one of the Catholic people who apparently was involved and got arrested right in front of her and handcuffed right in front of her for the Camden 28 case. But I'm trying to remember his name, but I thought you might. But anyway, so she came home with this story about this guy who was her legal assistant.
several were arrested that way. And at the trial, we used both defenses. The defendants spoke for themselves incredibly effectively. And the judge allowed an unusual arrangement where the lawyers were co-counsel with the defendants themselves, so that on any question, you know, an evidence question or a motion, whatever it was, all of the defendants, actually 17, went on trial initially. They severed some of them. Three lawyers, myself and two other lawyers, also part of this network of progressive lawyers, mainly through the guild. We knew each other. And all 17 of them and three of us would speak on any question, and opening and closing arguments as well. So it was not easy, and I go over that in the book. Relations among the defense were not easy. Some defendants preferred one defense over the other, and that had to be worked out. But it came across incredibly effectively in court, and to my shock, there was a complete acquittal.
It's amazing. Now, there's a movie about this case, is that right?
Yeah, it's called the Camden 28. It's quite well done by a fellow named Anthony Giacchino.
Yeah, it's supposed to be fabulous. And then, and this is the last question on this case, then we'll go to the next one, but some of the children of the people involved in Camden 28 were then arrested for other kinds of activities a few years ago, as I recall. Is that right? Do you recall that?
That's right, definitely, yes. Involving actions related to Iraq and Afghanistan.
That's right. I think it was in New York State somewhere, but...
David, we also found interesting the case of the fireman who was beaten by a police officer. You mentioned that this was a different kind of case for you when you got this.
Yes. My partner, Dave Rudofsky, and I were, both of us had our experience really in criminal law. We created the civil rights firm. It still goes on today. And we wanted to do civil rights law, and these would be mainly civil cases. And one of the big questions was whether we could succeed in police misconduct cases, because Philadelphia was known really, I guess, as much for Frank Rizzo and police brutality as for cheesesteaks in those years. And this was a major issue, but the feeling among a lot of people, among progressives and progressive lawyers, was that probably couldn't get a Philadelphia jury to rule against the police, that the sentiment was just too strongly in their favor. So the first case I did was for our office was about these two firemen. They had basically gotten Joe Rizzo, Frank's brother, who he made fire commissioner, very upset with them, and he had fired them, and one of them was beaten by the officer they complained against in a coma. And so this case went to trial. They didn't really make any settlement offer. And so here I am doing my first civil jury trial in federal court. The press is on it every day.
Amazing.
Yeah. And I'm again,
makes me nervous to even hear the story, David.
Well, I'm not 30 yet.
I know.
You know, all the cases you've done so far were before I was 30, and I was, you know, we can talk about that if you want. I was as shocked as anyone. I started out in engineering school. I did not have an activist or particularly progressive background, and here I find myself, you know, a movement lawyer in the midst of all this stuff. Anyway, Vince Marvesi, one of the firemen, testified first about how he was hit with a blackjack by this police officer in the police station, and he goes into a coma, and he's praying, you know, is he ever going to see his children? And the jurors started crying, several of them.
And so, in fact, the Daily News had a first-page headline that said, Ex-fireman prayed when beaten by cop.
Yes. Yes.
That's in the book.
Banner headline. When they do that on our Daily News, there's no room for text. It's the letters are so big, it covers the whole front page. So things were going, from my perspective, very well. Vince was a great witness. And all of a sudden, Frank Rizzo's city solicitor, a guy named Sheldon Albert, who was seen as a, you know, I said in the book, kind of, he was to law as Rizzo was to law enforcement. I mean, he was a very aggressive, not particularly skilled lawyer and seemed to polarize unnecessarily, right, instead of trying to work things out. Anyway, he comes down and asks the judge, this is the morning before Joe Rizzo is about to testify, and among other things, I'm ready to cross-examine about him banning the firemen from wearing anything other than white underwear. You know, you couldn't wear like a pale blue or a plaid. You know, you'd be in deep trouble in that department. Very authoritarian guy. He comes down and asks the judge, can he take me to breakfast so we can talk about a possible settlement, which, of course, they weren't interested in earlier. And I picked a number. We had asked for $50,000, and this is $1971 again. I don't know what the equivalent is, but a good middle-class income in those days was $10,000. So 50 was like, you know, five years of income for the two of them. So each would get 2.5 years of income, essentially, and I would have gotten 25% of that. So he's saying, well, you know, we've decided that we've changed our mind. We'll give you the $50,000 you asked for. So I said, well, you know, things have changed, and I think the appropriate figure is $200,000. He was somewhat livid, and he kept trying to get me off it. So I'm very inexperienced again at, you know, dealing with this money question and damages, but my strategy was to stick to the $200,000, see what happened. He said, it was a one-time offer, but I thought I could easily revive it. But it was some risk, and I talked to the clients about that. Anyway, he kept saying, no, but he's coming up, you know, 75, 100, 125. And finally, we go back into court, and I'm saying, no. And he makes one more phone call and comes up with $200,000.
David, we could listen to you for hours. These stories, your cases, your strategies are just an example for young lawyers practicing today. Most of the stories that you recount in your book go back a few decades, but one of the more recent challenges you brought related to gun manufacturers, and I remember reading about this in the law journals. Can you briefly summarize your theories on that?
Yeah, I was asked to be part of a task force that Mayor Rendell, now the governor here, set up on youth and guns. It's actually the leading force was a good friend of mine here named Mike DiBerardinis, and he was a recreation commissioner. Anyway, we started trying to figure out what, if anything, could be done about violence, guns, and particularly among poor young men. And so we had people from the ATF, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. We brought in some of the leading social science and public health people, and we started learning about the problem. And right away, I realized all my assumptions were wrong. I thought guns, well, used in crime, were usually stolen. Well, that turns out to be a very rare thing. The more I thought about it, I began focusing on the marketing of handguns, the ways in which the gun companies knowingly market guns such that they so easily are available on urban streets and, of course, make some money in doing that. I then started viewing it also as essentially a public health and a marketing problem, which led me to a tort that hadn't really been used, public nuisance. And so I came up with a theory that didn't require any law reform. This was the 90s. This was hardly the age of progressive law reform having much chance. The virtue, or one of the big virtues of my theory, was that it didn't require any change in the law, just application of principles that go back in common law hundreds of years. The normal plaintiff in such a suit is a city or a government that's trying to protect its people from a public health danger. And the public health danger was the easy availability of handguns for criminals and for youth who weren't legally supposed to have them. So I saw all of a sudden a really good suit in this, and I proposed it to Ed Rendell, and he was really excited. He was a prosecutor and really had a pretty keen sense, even before I started, about the terrible role that handguns are playing. But politically, it became difficult, and eventually he told me, pursue the suit. He hired me as counsel for the city of Philadelphia. But it became clear that he wasn't going to bring the suit. So, and we were on Nightline. We were all over about the suit, and no suit had even been brought yet. So I withdrew as counsel and for Philadelphia and released, you know, consistent with my obligations of attorney-client, released everything I could make public about the theory. And before you knew it, 40 cities brought the suit throughout the country, many with Republican mayors.
And that was by the year 2000.
Yeah. The first suits were brought in 98. We were doing well. For instance, we did better in the early stages, the motions to dismiss, than the state attorney general tobacco suits had done at a similar stage. They had been regularly rejected. We were running about half and half. We were winning about half of the motions to dismiss. Then the NRA and the gun manufacturers went to the legislatures and got first some state statutes granting immunity to the gun industry. And then finally Congress in 2005 in direct response to my suits. Now, I suppose this is a good testament on how good the theory was, but it didn't feel good at the time. Congress passed an immunity that extends to these suits and almost all civil suits that could be brought against gun manufacturers. For instance, gun manufacturers now can create a public nuisance, but no other company or industry or individuals are allowed to do so. They created this huge exception to the usual rules that apply to everybody else, and that ended the lawsuit. Theory, too, has gone on.
It's, the public nuisance theory.
Yeah, my theory is being used in the lead paint cases, all sorts of claims now where companies are charged with endangering the public.
Well, David, this has been great, and I want to recommend again the book Philadelphia Freedom, Memoir of a Civil Rights Lawyer. It is compelling. You can't put it down, and it gives you a real window on the last 40 years, not just in Philadelphia, but in this country, and really what difference lawyers and people's movement can make around winning important social and political issues. So thank you again, David.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to talk to you both.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Bankrupt General Motors will use some of the bailout billions to move their productions to Mexico and China. According to one report, Mexican workers will be earning $5 an hour, and that's without benefits. Meanwhile, the jobless rate in Detroit rose to 13% unemployment. Retired auto worker member of Local 235, Diane Feely, says that Detroit is 40% unoccupied. Homes are looted for furnaces and copper, and then are soon burned. We get an on-the-ground report on how the government has helped to lay off workers and demanded that the UAW give back retiree medical benefits. It's also explained how the media and politicians have mischaracterized the auto worker as highly paid at $73 an hour. Diane is a retired auto worker and an active advocate on behalf of auto workers.
Diane Feely, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Diane, can you give us a sense of what it's like in Detroit right now?
We were once a city of 2.2 million. Now we're probably around 900,000. So actually 40% of Detroit is vacant. Now, there have been some attempt to reclaim that vacancy, and there are 600 community gardens that are springing up. But we need a lot more than community gardens. We need manufacturing to be retooled, just as it was during World War II. It just took 8 months to retool those plants. And what we're suggesting, of course, is that since the United States, by and large, doesn't have mass transit, that's something that our plants could build. It used to be that GM manufactured buses, but there are no buses manufactured by the big three anymore. So there are a number of things that could keep the plants running. In addition to green vehicles, there's, you know, the whole range of mass transit. And what we're saying is you have to develop the auto industry into something much larger, and we think that that can be a transportation and energy industry. And if that were the conception, that then there would be lots of work that would be available instead of the situation that we face today. For example, Detroit no longer has any department stores in the city, although we are 140 square miles. We have no major grocery store in the city of Detroit either. So in many ways, it's a desert. No wonder fast food is what a lot of people eat, because that's the only food that's available to enlarged swaths of the city. You know, the city is poor. The city is composed of older people, retirees. It is the most segregated city in the country. It's 85% African American. We face a multiplicity of problems, and the city school system is falling apart, and city administration sees charter schools as the alternative, not the rebuilding of the public schools. It's kind of, in a short, what Detroit looks like. You could fit Manhattan, Boston, and San Francisco inside, physically inside Detroit, and have 20 square miles left over. So that just shows that the enormous population that, you know, that could fit in that 140 square miles. And with 900,000, you understand some of the problems that we face.
Diane, we also understand that homes are being looted for copper and burned to the ground. I assume the crime rate is rising as a result of all of this.
We have, especially in certain areas of the city. Actually, I live in a Mexican-American, pretty integrated neighborhood, and actually the homes are doing fairly well there, although the two homes across the street from me are not occupied. One of the homes has been burnt. But a friend of mine, for example, lives in a what was a very nice area on the east side, beautiful homes that had fireplaces in them. There are 19 homes on the block. 8 are not occupied now. And, of course, they have been vandalized. First, the furnace is taken out, and finally it's down to the copper wire that's taken out. And on the next block to her, again, another 19 houses, but in this case, 11 are unoccupied and 8 are occupied. So this is a struggle that's taking place on a block-by-block area to try to get, for example, the landlords to lock up so that the houses aren't broken into and looted. And there's all kinds of rumors about who's doing the looting. Some people feel it's very well organized looting that's taking place. But of course, you don't really know. That's just one of the rumors that's going around. I guess I focus mostly on the questions of police brutality, because this is a big problem in our city. It was just revealed in the papers the other day that in 2007, the last time that we have statistics revealed, there were actually 10 police murders. That is, the police murdered 10 civilians. And there was one recent case of a young man who ran away from the cops. he was tasered and he died. So that's a big problem.
You're describing all of these enormous problems in a very depressed city. But GM is receiving billions of dollars in taxpayer bailout money. Why isn't this money reaching Detroit?
Well, GM isn't interested in making sure that auto workers have that money. What's really sad is that both the government and GM have insisted through the contracts that more auto workers are laid off and more benefits are cut back. For example, in both the recent negotiation of the UAW with Chrysler and General Motors, just before bankruptcy hit, the U.S. Treasury Department actually demanded that the UAW give up the retiree vision benefits and dental benefits. Now, why in an economic downturn are you going after, you know, small benefits that retirees have? Again, the contracts ripped apart the previous contract. Now, auto workers have been suffering concessions over the last 30 years, and yet what's being asked of us is more concessions. And yet, out of the price of the car, the auto workers' wages and benefits represent somewhere between 8 and 10% of the total cost. So it's you could say it's irrational, but I guess I would say that, like Douglas Frazier said so many years ago, it's a one-sided class war, and they feel that they can take advantage of workers, and it's okay to devastate communities.
Diane, you've put forth the argument that the government should buy Chrysler and GM and turn them into a public trust.
Yes, I think it should be a public trust because, obviously, this has tremendous implications for many communities in, you know, particularly in Michigan, but also other communities across the particularly the Midwest and other parts of the country as well. And so it seems to me it's not just a private good. The government has put in all of this money, and like other countries, at least when the government gives money to the corporations, they often demand that the corporations not lay off workers. But in our case, the government has helped GM and Chrysler to lay off more workers. That's what they're demanding. So what's the solution? It seems to me, okay, let's have a public trust, just like public utilities, but more so, in which we actually take this situation and say, all right, this is the crisis that we're in, which is not just the auto crisis, but which is also a climate crisis, and say, how do we reorganize our auto-centric society into being a mass transit society, and what can our plants and a new conception of manufacturing, what could that bring us in the 21st century?
We're speaking with Diane Feely, retired auto worker in Detroit. Diane, how do you account for the real lack of anything effective in protecting American workers? In Germany, for example, where you have a conservative government, the auto workers there are doing much better than here under a conservative government. And here, the city of Detroit, which was auto capital for years, has been devastated. The government gives $11.4 trillion to the banks and manages to lay off workers in Detroit. How do you account for this one-sided class struggle, as auto worker president Doug Frazier said years ago?
Well, I think there's two aspects to it. One is the fact that over the last 30 years, the union has taken the position that we must do everything to keep the companies profitable. So there's no concession we can't make. And presumably, this is to save our jobs. But if you look at the facts, it's not at all true. When I started working in the 70s, GM employed something like 450,000 workers. Currently, GM employs 60,000 workers, and they're going to go down to something like 45,000. There's just been a dramatic restructuring that's occurred over a period of time. But the second factor, which I think is really important, is that the media and the politicians most especially have demonized the auto worker. And we're supposed to be the very high-paid $73 an hour worker, and we're on a privileged platform, and we think of ourselves as special. Now, notice they never talk about how much the CEOs make per hour, and in fact, we don't make anywhere near $73 an hour. That's a miscalculation. Auto workers make $26 to $28 an hour plus benefits. The way they get to that $73 an hour is they total in all of the benefits and the pensions that the retirees receive to total that $73 an hour. So we are, as retirees, we are on the backs of the current workforce. Well, it seems to me that's not the proper way to calculate. But I would also point out that because the UAW agreed to two-tier wages, young auto workers or auto workers who have just come into the plant are not making $26 an hour. They're making $14 an hour. So that's the dramatic shift that's taken place, and it's just the media and the politicians that perpetuate this notion that auto workers are so high paid, and you who are a waitress or you who work at a $9 an hour job, you should be jealous and resentful of us and our benefits, rather than saying what we used to say is that those who are the higher paid workers help to bring up the wages of the lower paid workers. I think part of that, again, is because many unions just cared about our own members and didn't understand that we have to also go out and organize lower paid workers, workers who aren't in the union, and try to bring them up, because if they are not brought up, we are going to be brought down, and that's what's happening.
I understand that Hummer is now producing in China.
A lot of the plants, in fact, my plant, which was a parts plant, a first-tier parts supplier, is also producing in China. Yes, this is a growing area. And one of the things that really infuriated the UAW and auto workers in general is that GM said it was going to take the money it received from the U.S. government and use that to produce more cars made in other countries.
Diane, how much money did GM receive from the taxpayer bailout?
They received it in two different bundles, so I'm not sure what the total amount is, but something on the order of $20 billion.
What's the real cost to American workers of moving these jobs overseas?
I feel that while certainly free trade agreements have had tremendously bad implications for American workers, but I also think they've had bad implications for the workers and peasants in other countries too. You have to understand that it's not just that the jobs left the U.S. The jobs left the states where there were better labor laws, or they went to more rural areas. For example, for my employer, he has dumped the work out of the plants that refuse to give concessions. So if we stand back, we say, okay, what the auto companies and the parts suppliers have done is they've overbuilt. So they're now at a world scale capable of producing 93 million vehicles a year. But, of course, people can't buy around the world that many vehicles. And they use those plants whipsawing workers in one plant against another, whether it's inside the United States, whether it's inside Michigan, or whether it's at a world level. So, for example, shortly after the CEO of my company bought our plants, he also bought other auto parts plants in Ohio and in Michigan, where he paid $14 an hour. And those workers were represented by the UAW also, and then brought the new work to them if we wouldn't accept concessions. So it's not just at a global level that this whipsawing has occurred, but it's also throughout the country, and of course especially that plants have moved to the south where there are right to work for less laws.
Diane, have plants moved to Mexico as well?
Yes, but you have to understand that the auto industry has been an international industry for a long time. I believe the first Ford plant set up in South Africa dates from the 1920s. So originally those plants were set up to serve the local market. And it's only later that they've been used to whipsaw workers.
Do you know how much the workers make, say, in Mexico?
Well, they used to make more in comparison to what we made. I would say 25 years ago, they probably made the equivalent of maybe what would be $15 an hour now. Today, they make much less. They make approximately $5 an hour. And, of course, their benefits are, they have a much less benefits package. My feeling is that part of what we have to do is not only organize workers in the United States, because in the private sector, we represent 7.5% of the population. But we also have to reach out to the Mexican trade unionists who work in assembly and manufacturing in Mexico and try to build a bridge to raise their wages and benefits as well.
This has been really enlightening. We would love to have you back on, and thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Thanks, Diane.
Now, if you want higher wages, let me tell you what to do. You got to talk to the workers in the shop with you. You got to build you a union, got to make it strong. But if you all stick together, boys, it won't be long. You get shorter hours, better working conditions, vacations with pay, take your kids to the seashore. It ain't quite this simple, so I better explain just why you got to ride on the union train. Because if you wait for the boss to raise your pay, we'll all be awaiting till Judgment Day. We'll all be buried, gone to heaven. St. Peter will be the straw boss then. Now you know you're underpaid, but the boss says you ain't. He speeds up the work till you're about to faint. You may be down and out, but you ain't beaten. You can pass out a leaflet and call a meeting. Talk it over, speak your mind, decide to do something about it. Of course, the boss may persuade some poor damn fool to go to your meeting and act like a stool, but you can always tell a stool, though, that's a fact. He's got a yaller streaker running down his back. He doesn't have to stool. He'll always get along on what he takes out of blind men's cups. You got a union now, and you're sitting pretty. Put some of the boys on the steering committee. The boss won't listen when one guy squawks, but he's got to listen when the union talks. He'd better be mighty lonely. Everybody decide to walk out on him. Suppose they're working you so hard it's just outrageous, and they're paying you all starvation wages. You go to the boss and the boss would yell, before I raise your pay, I'd see you all in hell. Well, he's puffing a big cigar, feeling mighty slick, because he thinks he's got your union licked. Well, he looks out the window and what does he see but 1,000 pickets, and they all agree he's a bastard. Unfair! Slave driver. Bet he beats his wife. Now, boys, you come to the hardest time. The boss will try to bust your picket line. He'll call out the police, the National Guard. They'll tell you it's a crime to have a union card. They'll raid your meeting. They'll hit you on the head. They'll call every one of you a damn red unpatriotic. Japanese spies. Sabotaging national defense. But out at Ford, here's what they found, and out at Vulti, here's what they found, and out at Alice Chalmers, here's what they found, and down at Bethlehem, here's what they found, that if you don't let red baiting break you up, and if you don't let stool pigeons break you up, and if you don't let vigilantes break you up, and if you don't let race hatred break you up, you'll win. What I mean, take it easy, but take it.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.